All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. James Austin Johnson is here. And it's weird with this guy. Hilarious guy. Great impressionist. But nice guy. Smart guy. Interesting story. But someone forwarded me that Jimmy Fallon clip of him doing Bob Dylan, the three different Bob Dylans or four. And I didn't really realize that it was the same guy who did Trump on SNL, but I don't really watch SNL. And then when I was in Nashville, I was on stage and I was going back and forth with Chad Ryden, my Prince's Chicken experience. You know, apparently James Austin Johnson was there, as was another guy, and Chad and Ryan Singer, to witness my face burning. But I don't remember them. And I don't know if that's just because of the heat of the peppers annihilated a part of my memory, a sort of spice-related blackout, which is totally possible. But apparently we hung around most of the day, me and James Austin Johnson and a couple other fellas. And I went back and I was watching those Trump videos he did, just the ones when he was on the street, and they're fucking hilarious. Hilarious. So I talked to him when I was in New York, and it was a completely surprising conversation, to be quite honest with you. In the sense that he's got an interesting story, a unique story, a story that deals with Jesus. Anytime Jesus can find his way into a story that isn't his, that's the whole goal of it, isn't it? Jesus is designed to infect. And James was infected with Jesus. But it was good. It was like one of those positive bacterias, one of those good ones, one of those gut bugs that you want to keep, the Jesus. Folks, if you're a WTF Plus subscriber, listen up. You got an email from us today, and if you didn't get a chance to read it, here's the gist. We sent you all individualized promo codes so you can refer a friend to WTF Plus, and they get a month for free. That's any tier of WTF Plus. Refer as many people as you want, because starting in January, we're going to tally up all the referrals, and the listener with the most will get a gift from us, along with a shout-out here on the show. So check your inbox for the email with your special referral code in sight. Who doesn't want me to shout out their name on the show or give you a gift? I don't even know what the gift is going to be. Maybe I do. Maybe I know exactly what it is. Maybe it's in my house. Maybe it's a new car. It's not. Not a new car. The special. So we're getting right into the cutting of this thing, and I don't know if you're in the kind of job where if you do your job at the end of the day, you can just watch yourself do your job from an outside vantage point. It's not great because you want to do a good job. You want to be able to live with the job you're doing, or certainly maybe even like the job you did. But when you do TV, it's taken me a long time, TV or movies, to sort of be able to watch myself with enough distance and enough comfort to not be like, oh, fuck, I fucked it. So now I don't watch myself and think like, oh, man, God damn it. I watch myself and go like, that was okay. Oof, that one, well, what are you going to do? 1 out of 3. Oh, look at that. Okay. 2 out of 4. Ooh, that was good. So it becomes sort of like that. But then if I watch it again, it's sort of like, all right, I was in it. The vibe was right. So when I first watched part of the cut the other day from Fine Arts, my director, it's his name, Stephen Fine Arts. You know, within 15 minutes, I was like, man, I was not happy. I wasn't unhappy. I just thought like, it's intense. It's like, I'm going too fast. What's it? But I just couldn't process it because it was too close. It was Thursday. I wasn't ready. But then I watched it yesterday and I was like, you know what? It's all there. It's solid. Let's make it just sing. Let's just tweak it. We got to get it down a few minutes. Let's figure it out. Let's smooth it out. But I was definitely in the zone. I was where I needed to be. And I was able to watch it and make notes and make decisions. That's progress. You know, when you don't automatically think you did a shitty job, or you don't think that you're not, you know, good enough, and you kind of live with that every day with your job. You know, that's bad, no matter what your job is. You know, ultimately, nothing matters. It's all going to go away. It doesn't end well for anybody. Give yourself a fucking break, he said to himself. Right? Right? Ooh, man. Oh, man. Cats are okay. Fucking Charlie Beans. Fucking Sammy Smushy. Fucking Buster Kitten. God damn cats. I had the house cleaned yesterday, and I just watched. I was sitting at the counter having coffee, and I watched Charlie Beans climb up on the counter opposite me, get into the sink, and pee in it. Could have been worse. Could have peed someplace else that wasn't as convenient as a sink. Just peed in the sink, looking right at me. All right. I don't think there's anything wrong with him. We'll see if it happens again. I'm not sure why he did it. It had just been cleaned. Maybe he was like, this doesn't smell like mine anymore. All right, look, you guys. James Austin Johnson is a very talented man, very funny man, does great impressions, cracks me the fuck up. There's a couple of things. His Scooby-Doo Trump impression thing on YouTube or whatever it's on, or and the Dylan stuff. I have to not watch too often so I can get laughs from watching it for years to come. He's a member of the Not Ready for Primetime Players. The final SNL of the year airs this Saturday on NBC. And we had a lovely conversation in my hotel room in New York City where the sun was glaring. It was just glaring. It was beating down on him. I don't know why I didn't tell him to move or why we just didn't close the curtain. But when we finished, he had to step away. I think he might have got a sunburn through the window. So this is me talking to James Austin Johnson in New York.
So I'll hold the mic away if
I can ride the fader.
See, just, that's how I know you're a musician. Is you know you love the knobs.
I'm on the knobs. Well, I'm not. But I'm bad at this shit. I mean, really? I've been doing this. Where are we at? 12 years, and I'm sitting in a hotel room with a Zoom.
How old's that Zoom?
This is not that old a Zoom.
Oh, okay.
Why, does it look old?
Well, you still got the plastic covering on the little LCD there.
Yeah, I mean, I could take that off, but I think it would ruin something.
I think men have a fear about peeling the sticker off the LCD of something.
Well, you want to keep things pristine.
Yeah.
Why have you
my dad, like, every car my dad's ever had, he leaves the film on the leased car. And he never takes it off the SiriusXM little screen thing.
Right.
It gets nasty and gritty and full of his little powdered gas station powdered donut grit.
Yeah. Lint. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
and
a man
just stays
thing.
On, it's a certain type of man thing. I don't know what you're protecting, what you're holding on to.
I don't know.
Like it's gonna stay pristine.
Yeah, the car's virginity, you know.
So now I didn't realize this and I feel bad about it, but I don't think this is the first time we've been in a hotel room together.
We met Mark in Nashville.
I know
where I'm from.
Yeah.
What, 10, 12 years ago?
It must be. Had I started, I was just the beginning of the podcast because I was doing a show in Nashville at Polk, James K. Polk Center.
At the TPAC.
TPAC, yeah.
At the big theater. And that's the one. That's when you've made it.
Right, but I was in the smaller theater.
Oh, but I mean, still.
Yeah, it's
that's
nice.
Where Jeff Tweedy plays. That's where Jerry Seinfeld plays.
I bet you Tweedy and I were in the same room, but Jerry was in the bigger room.
I think you're the Wilco of Jerry Seinfeld.
That's right. I think that's true.
Can I pay you a compliment?
I think it's true.
Yeah, Ryan Singer was my buddy. He was opening for you, and he invited...
Right.
Yeah.
Because I was in... Because the reason... And I was just talking about you to my producer, Brendan, when I saw the Dylan thing. You know, I'm like, this guy's great. You know, wait, how do I not know this guy? And he's like, and then 2 days later, I do the Nashville thing, and Chad Ryden is there.
Oh, okay.
So, and I hadn't seen Chad in forever. You know, I probably hadn't seen him since with you, and someone asked me to tell that Prince's Chicken story, and I said, who was with us? It was me, you, and there was another guy,
John Thornton.
Was there John Thornton?
His name was John Thornton Jr., and he was a comedian in Nashville. He became a Baptist pastor.
Are you serious?
Yes, and then a socialist activist.
Wait, but weren't you there?
I was there, too.
So there were five of us.
There was Ryan, me and John.
Chad.
Chad.
And me.
And you.
What? So what happened to the other guy?
He's
not a comic anymore.
I don't think he's a comic anymore. He was a Baptist pastor.
Yeah.
He got frustrated because he was trying to use the emergency, like, social rescue funds that some churches will have, especially the big fancy ones.
Yeah.
Will have like a slush fund that is meant for, oh, we're getting 30 families who are evacuating a storm in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're taking them in with some of our families. So this money's for them ostensibly.
Yeah.
But a lot of the big churches, you know, they hate socialism. They hate handouts. They're Republicans. So they sit on the money and it's just, they get all this money. So when he was an associate pastor at this one Baptist, I guess, mega church or whatever, he said, well, we've got people in debt in our church. We've got two people I know are homeless. Let's spend this money.
Yeah.
And then that just began a constant fight of him wanting to
help
and do Christian shit.
Yeah.
And that in itself is sort of a microcosm of my own experience with the Christian church, which I was heavily involved in for most of my life.
Do you know this kid, Andrew Stanley?
Andrew Stanley, no.
I think that's his name. He opened for me.
Oh.
In Nashville, and he comes from a family of ministers.
Oh, really?
His grandfather's somebody Stanley. That writes books, like, and he's homeschooled. A lot of his angle is the homeschooled angle. But he's great. He's great.
See, I think I grew up super crazy Christian intensity, and then I meet people who are like homeschooled. And I'm like, I went to public school. I sat at lunch table with Jews and talked about the Daily Show.
You did?
Yeah.
You found the Jews in Nashville?
I found the Jews in Nashville.
The three?
And they introduced me to Conan and the Daily Show and, you know, Steely Dan and, like, the cool shit that I like as an adult.
Really?
Yeah.
You lay that squarely on the Jews.
I don't know. They happen
to
be Jewish people.
No, it's good. It's good to hear positive things about Jews. I'm not a huge Steely Dan fan. I've tried, but it...
Really? You're not a Steely Dan fan?
Look, I am. I get it. But do I go to it?
Do you go to it? No.
Yeah. So anyway.
Sorry.
You were brought up very religious?
Yeah, I grew up in the Church of the Nazarene, which is like if Methodists were really anti-fun.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like we don't drink, we don't smoke, no bowling alleys, no engagement rings.
Yeah.
Let's exchange watches when we get married.
Right.
You know, women can't wear shorts. This is all stuff that ended in, like, I guess the 80s, but that was the legacy of this church.
But do you come from ministers?
No, I come from like teachers and school administrators, but my dad worked at a Nazarene college. And my mom's dad was president of Trevecca, which is a Nazarene college in downtown Nashville.
So Nazarene is just a subdivision of
Christian? It's just one of the denominations, one of the million
denominations. Is it a popular one?
They say that there are more Southern Baptists in Mississippi than there are Nazarenes in the entire world. That's like the little aphorism that is shared
That goes around the Nazarene community.
It's like the number one Christian church in Haiti or something like that. It's like a missionary thing. And I don't know. So I love all those people.
A boutique Christianity.
Listen, Mark, I went through all of my... I've been through every phase of my relationship with that community.
With Jesus or just a community?
With the community. With Jesus, it's like, great. I'll never get rid of Jesus in my head. You think I can get rid of Jesus at this point?
I don't know.
I don't think I can.
I don't know. I don't know what that feels like.
I don't want to be Christian. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Like, but I mean, I don't know what it feels like to have Jesus so far in your head that you can't extricate it.
Yeah, I get what you mean. Well, religion. Well, my wife grew up in a similar fashion in the Baptist church, and we watched these cult documentaries. And then when the credits are rolling, every time we look at each other, we go, we were raised in a cult. We're brainwashed.
Yeah.
This is unhealthy.
Right.
One of us is going to murder someone at some point.
Yeah. You don't know when you're going to be activated.
I don't know when it's going to kick in, and we're scared about that. But
How many kids in your family?
I was the youngest of three boys.
Hmm.
So you
actually had the best opportunity to become a free thinker in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You could see all the damage. They're just taking the hits. You know, they're at the front of the ship.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, it's also that you're also in the position to be the most of a people-pleasing, religious, like, psychopath. Where when you're the youngest, your whole mission is impressing people that are much older than you.
Okay.
Right? When you're the youngest, all of your attitude and your value comes from making two people in their 40s and then two big boys relate to you. So that's where I think the impressions and comic stand-up and all the stand-up
and just to
stuff,
get attention.
Just to get attention. Yeah. And then the Nazarene world is very elders-focused. I mean, those Christian... Those churches are all about the old man who is the most ordained and the most revered guy, right?
So there's always like an old bearded guy there? Or?
There's always an old bald man who is the most conservative, hard-ass man you've ever met. And he is a bad motherfucker.
Yeah.
And
he's the elder.
He's the elder and everyone respects him. So it's always about the oldest man in the room. It's, when I go to these, like, I go to like liberal friends, houses, like kids who grew up with NPR and college professor parents, people who have kids late in life, it seems like it's all about the kids.
Yeah,
it seems like it's all about life is totally focused on soccer and flute and their parties and their friends. I did not grow up in an environment like that. It was always about the doctor
and flute.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
These people where the life is about the children. I don't remember growing up in a... I was always dragged to some kind of luncheon where a solemn man was talking about the work they're doing in China or whatever. You know what I mean?
And you just sat there and were told to be
quiet? I just sat there in a little suit. We watched these VHS tapes where I'm squirming in a little suit at some Nazarene conference, you know, in Indianapolis.
But I thought... It's weird because I guess that's true. I mean, I guess the ability to define yourself comes later as the third kid after you see your brothers go through a certain amount of hardship.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to assume that at some point there's the people pleasing and then there's this sort of like, well, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what I mean. Like, you know, I've already done my therapy thing and so now I'm at the new place where instead of like being a resentful participant in all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Now I'll go to church with my family and like try to see what they see in it. I'm trying to have respect for who all these people are that.
And how old are you?
33.
Well, that's good. That's good because I think I'm just getting that now and my parents are very old.
Really?
Well, I don't know if it's respect, but there's something's given way.
Yeah.
You know, like you can hold on to this anger for so long, but I've been doing this on stage where I say, but at some point you realize like, yeah, I kind of won. And you know, it's like
you got what you wanted,
right? Well, so let's let it go.
So let's let it go.
Show up for them a little bit.
Show up for them, and I want their final years to be of value. I see the value in other people's lives now.
You do?
I don't know by like, yeah, right? Like you,
I do. Well, yeah, I
you
think
get a
so.
Taste of what you're working for, and then you're like, oh, I want.
Yeah, and also when you're 33, so like you know, I've got a lot of years on these, and then all of a sudden it's like, you know, you realize like it's not going to end well for anybody.
We all die alone, Mark.
Exactly. But like you see these people and there's that discomfort of like, you know, look at this old asshole. Why is he got to be like that? And then you're like, who wouldn't be?
Right.
How do you go out with any grace?
Yeah, you don't.
Not really. Even like, you know, when in thinking about Bob Dylan and the arc of your impression of him, it's like, you know, for some reason, that guy, after all he's done, is just he just is dead set on dying on a tour bus.
For real.
I know.
He loves... What musician, I think this is what truly made me love him after years of like going back and forth between liking him and not liking him.
Did you grow up with it or did the Jews give you Dylan too?
I got into Bob Dylan, I think at the time most people do, like in college trying to be smart.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, right. What was your introduction? What was the record?
It was actually high school. My high school girlfriend, who was really cool.
Yeah.
Really cool high school girlfriend. Got me Blood on the Tracks.
Yeah, that's the one, right?
And I listened to Blood on the Tracks a lot, and I was like, oh, this is incredible. This has what I'm looking for in books that I'm reading.
Sure.
Plus, you know, what I want from, like, the Americana roots rock
all
music that I listened to.
Right, because that was already happening.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and then you probably, and then if you move on to Blonde on Blonde, and you listen to Visions of Joanna, if you have the same experience I did, it's like, it's all in here!
Yeah.
It's all in this song!
This is the song.
Yeah.
No, that is the song, right? That's like the song that has a lot of Bob Dylan moves in it, I feel like. And Blonde on Blonde, the way that the band is composed, like in the songs, the way that that band is put together, that session group or whatever in Nashville, to me, that's the Bob Dylan sound. Even though he's had a million sounds, Blonde on Blonde is, I think, what most people are picturing when they hear a Bob Dylan song, like when they are imagining a Bob Dylan song.
If it's not the original Dylan.
If it's not, blown in the wind.
Right, right,
but,
right.
I don't think anybody really relates to that Dylan anymore. That's that music to me sounds like such a fad.
Yeah,
and then the rest of his music is so timeless to me.
It's only if it sounds like a fad if you just let it hang there. But if you try to wedge it into context,
yeah,
it makes perfect sense.
Of course it does. Yeah,
but I thought that was like the funniest. The for some reason the moment that resonates with me in that impression you did, or that series of impressions that Dylan you did on Fallon, was that I think Calvin Coolidge said that. Like, of all the references of anybody in the world that's a public figure that no one gives a fuck about.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, he's... I think he was at, I think he had, there's a youth to Bob Dylan's pretentiousness in a lot of the early songs where I think he's showing off how much he's read, right? How aware he is of the outside world.
Well, I just think, like, you know, when I try to kind of wrap my brain around I think he was all hopped up on speed and
he was on drugs as well. Yeah.
And sort of a vague sense of self, but he was obviously gifted with some kind of like, it's a talent, but he's like a vessel of some kind. You don't, there are guys you meet, like even when you riff, that like if you're riffing Trump or you're riffing now, yeah, and things fall into your head, you know, there are just some people that it's so much content,
right,
that is falling into them and through mm-hmm. them. You can't even understand it because you want to lock into some of these songs and like, no, oh, that's who he is. Who the fuck knows who that guy is?
Yeah.
He's just this weird vessel.
Maybe doesn't know. Yeah.
I don't know.
He's full of all this beat poetry and, you know, I guess Minnesota like folklore or
yeah,
whatever.
But right. And then there's a
Lead Belly song.
This period where, you know, like I was, there's a documentary about Ramblin' Jack Elliott. Have you seen that?
No.
Where, you know, they were peers.
Yeah.
And at the early time, you know, Dylan used to look up to Jack.
Okay.
Who was kind of this kind of folksy, you know, guitar playing, you know, mm-hmm. you know, cowboy storyteller guy.
Okay, yeah.
And it becomes very clear, because I think Jack's daughter made it, that the early Dylan is some amalgamation of things he picked up, but it's mostly Ramblin' Jack. Like,
right,
the sort of like, I think Calvin Coolidge said that,
yeah,
is a Ramblin' Jack trip. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
okay.
Funny aside.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
And that's when you start to, like, if you're like me, that's your, like, oh, fucking Dylan stole it. You know, but then you realize, like, well, he's been a lot of things.
Yeah.
And you're not behind, in whatever Ramblin' Jack thinks, behind every genius, there's at least three people going, like, that fucker took my.
Oh, yeah. You have to steal. I think you fully have to steal, right? Like,
well, I think that it's something you're not conscious of. I think that, like, when you're hungry creatively and you're talented, you just start to absorb things.
Yeah. Even when you are kind of. When you're younger and you're just mimicking something that you saw another comedian do,
yeah,
which is how I started. I started fully stealing. I didn't realize that the stealing was bad or had a moral
jokes or,
content
or
to
tone.
My first stand-up that I ever did.
How old were you?
Okay, let's see. The first time I did my own stand-up, I was 14. I probably started a little earlier than that.
Really?
In drama class at school.
High school.
In middle school.
Middle school.
In middle school, we did these competitions after school, forensics competitions, where you would memorize a monologue.
Yeah.
And you would go do it.
Yeah.
At some competition at some other public school.
Yeah.
And I got assigned humorous interpretation.
Yeah.
And that was my category.
Okay.
And I got some Three Little Pigs story or something my first year I did it. I lost every competition. My second year I said, can I do 8 minutes from my favorite stand-up album?
Oh, that's a great kind of exercise, and you're free to do it. It's middle school. Who gives a shit?
My teacher was like, it just has to be a published work, and you can do it at these competitions. So I transcribed 8 minutes from, have you ever met this guy, Mark? Brad Stein.
No.
Brad Stein's album, Rebel Without a Curse.
What is that?
What do you think the title Rebel Without a Curse means? This is a clean comedian who is advertising himself as a clean comedian.
Uh-huh.
And he's also a rebellious clean comedian.
So, no, yeah. So
this guy is now
no fucks,
and also no fucks given if you don't like his.
But was this a regional act, or was he?
This was a guy. He was in L.A. in the '80s, comedy boom, and then
Brad Stein.
And then he settled in Franklin, Tennessee, outside Nashville. That's where the rich Republicans live.
Okay, so he blew it in L.A. and left, or
I think he got religion, or he got into conservative politics.
Okay.
And so
he found the record.
I found a guy. I found the conservative, clean comedy Robin Williams.
Okay.
And I repeated his jokes about cars have too many airbags these days.
Uh-huh.
You know, his stuff that I thought was cool.
Sure.
And I started winning like gold medals by like repeating this guy's stand up.
But you know what's funny is that you could have toured with that at 14 and no one would fucking know who Brad Stein is. I've heard a lot of guys. I don't know that guy.
I think you know what? I think he's big in the Christian men's conference world, and I assume now in this like growing right wing media streaming world too.
Sure,
you know.
So he's like doing guest spots or opening for Steven Crowder at certain venues.
Oh God, I hope not. You know, I can say that as someone who grew up in Nashville, who grew up working in, you know, in Christian media, conservative media, I guess you'd say, it's been an incredible shame to watch the like slide to the far and alt right of a lot of these people who were.
Well, I think, but even probably when you were growing up, it was more nuanced in terms of the politics. I mean, there was concern, but it was more of a family values trip, right?
And well, Bush, right, was at the time seen as like a
W or the original
W.
Guy. Yeah,
this is 2000. You know, that's when 2000 is my year of I want to be a comedian.
Right.
That's the year I can remember. I was watching Daryl Hammond do Al Gore on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Will Ferrell doing George W. Bush.
Yeah.
And I was getting into comedy albums, and that's when I can remember all this kind of starting for me.
Yeah.
And I came from a W obsessed family. This is a guy who's going to be a good they called it compassionate conservatism,
sure.
Right? We're going to let in immigrants.
Yeah.
So my family was obsessed with W.
It's weird, these guys with this kind of lughead charisma, how for regular people,
right.
Like even my dad's wife, they're enamored with the charisma.
Yeah.
Of this, because like these are not smart people. Even Trump has a weird fucked up charisma. It's a belligerence that people identify, but it's really at the base of it. It's this, they love them.
There's like a guerrilla sexuality to some of these guys. You know what I mean?
But you don't feel it. Like, I don't find that, you know, Trump or W was necessarily sexual. Like, I don't sense a sexuality, but there's a sturdiness to what people project on them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they find them funny.
They're just empty enough that they can put a lot of their dreams into them. And
they're funny. I mean, you know, Trump, intentional funny. I don't know how intentionally funny W was, but it was that buffoonery that was sort of endearing.
Disarming. And
yeah, as he's bombing Iraqis,
yeah.
You know, he can't get out of a room. You know, there was a doorknob problem. But,
I mean, yeah, I think that was like a fun environment, and looking back on it, a good time, if you'll excuse me, to be in that right-wing world. Like, it was post 9/11.
Yeah,
people were praying before every sporting event.
Yeah,
remember that time? That was like a very like American conservatism is a good thing.
Right.
That was a widespread belief at the time, right?
Because of 9/11.
Because of 9/11,
it brought everybody together. And
Joe Biden
didn't.
Supported the Iraq War. Everyone did.
Yeah.
You know, it was this. But it was this time. It felt like a good time to be doing comedy, even though it was a horrific war period.
But so it's interesting, though. So when you say you were dug into Christian media outside of the Brad Stein record, who I guess wasn't a Jew or maybe was and found religion. But I mean, how were you dug into Christian media? Just that was what you were taking in?
So growing up in Nashville, I always wanted to be a comedian or an actor or something. Yeah. And I got plugged into acting with a friend of a friend at church. One of my friends at church, his dad had like a commercial production studio.
Yeah.
And I would take improv classes there sometimes. And I met this woman who did a sketch review, educational sketch review called Janet's Planet.
Yeah.
Her name's Janet Ivy. She's still working. She's one of the best people ever. And she got me hooked up with like an agent in Nashville. And I started auditioning for little things you can audition for in Nashville, which is a really small market.
And you're what, 15, 14?
I'm like 12, 13, 14.
Wow.
Doing
so
this stuff.
You wanted to do it.
I wanted to do it. And my parents would just drop me off at auditions. I didn't have stage parents. I figured it all out by myself.
But they were supportive?
They were supportive. And the only things to act in Nashville were like Baptist propaganda videos. Like, the Southern Baptist Convention is headquartered in Nashville.
Yeah.
Their publishing company is called Lifeway Christian Resources.
Yeah.
I started working as like an in-house player for Lifeway Christian Resources as a kid acting in little morality videos that they show at like Sunday school or youth group.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it's like a little cute little demonstration before the pastor brings it home with a terrifying admonition of sin. So that's how I got my start. And those are the first directors I worked with. Those are the first crews I worked with, were these like non-union guys who made Baptist propaganda.
And are they all these, I guess they're all still out there. The propaganda videos, they're still in circulation.
They're somewhere. I recently was able to watch some files of them, and they're not very propaganda-y. I don't want you to imagine something USSR style. They're little agitprop skits. They're little skits.
Yeah.
But, you know, Disney style. They're like Disney Channel looking stuff.
And they're for kids?
They're for kids and they're cute. But here's the thing. The longer I did them, the older I got, the age group that I'm making videos for scales up in content. Uh-huh. So by the time I'm 19, I'm like 17, 18. I'm in high school. I'm acting in a video where my character is saying, and separation of church and state, that's not even in the Constitution. That's from a letter Jefferson wrote. So you don't even have to do that. Like, I'm arguing against the separation of church and state. And that's sort of, I think, that's what made me go, I think Christianity is maybe not my thing.
So it was like, that's how you had the realization, is that you were a tool.
Well, it wasn't immediate, because I immediately then went after that and did an anti-abortion major motion picture.
For what? What was it?
It was called October Baby. It opened number 8 in America. Against the Hunger Games. The Hunger Games sucked up so much money that our, you know, $2 million Christian movie snuck in there. A lot of people saw it, you know? There's a huge market for that stuff.
Yeah, it's growing, apparently.
And I think it's growing. Like, Lionsgate opened up a little house with those guys that I worked with.
Yeah.
And
wait till the movies come out. Like, what about the Jews? When's that movie coming?
What about the Jews?
So that was your whole life.
That was my life, and I struggled between wanting to be in Hollywood and wanting to be a good Christian son.
But after you do you start doing the impression, the Brad Stein piece, and that sort of inspires you to do comedy because you realize the power of laughter, and you were able to just get it by cheating in a way.
A little bit.
But not really. I mean, it's a script to script. So what do you know, to catch up with it. How do you go on from there with the comedy thing? You just start building impressions, or?
I didn't grow up really a huge impressionist. That was like my first thing I would do to impress adults when I was young. And then, you know, I can remember doing Daryl Hammond's Al Gore.
Yeah.
Was one I would do at church, like for adults, and they would freak out. And I was like, I don't have no clue who either of these two men are.
Yeah.
But me imitating it is making this grown man freak out that I'm making fun of Al Gore and saying SNL stuff.
I mean, last night I'm on stage and all of a sudden I'm talking like I'm from New Jersey. I don't know why.
Yeah,
it's not an intentional thing, but if I talk to somebody from New York, I'm gonna talk
you're gonna
like
start
that.
Doing that.
Do you do that?
Yawling when you're in Alabama
a little
that. Yeah,
but not, I would hope not.
Yeah,
the real problem with that is with when I interview black people and I start not knowing that it's happening,
you're letting blackness into you.
Yeah. But I don't mind it, but it's kind of odd. Do you do that though?
Do I code switch?
Yeah,
I find myself doing that sometimes.
Yeah,
and you know, there was sometimes you can't help it. I mean, I lived with two black comedians in L.A. for a few years.
I just
years.
Mean with anybody with a vocal, with a different sort of, do you glom it?
Or that
do
that you... I really try to resist the urge to.
Yeah.
What I do now with my wife is as soon as we walk away, I just...
You do.
I lash into the person. I'm immediately, you know, if we're walking down the street and we hear a snatch of conversation, I lean over to my wife and I'm like, well, he didn't even say that. He didn't even say that. And when I walked in, he looked at me like I was, and I said, Brian? And that's all I heard from the woman who passed me.
Yeah.
But I do that to my wife every time we pass anybody.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe one of the things that makes New York the only place that you can be someone who does impressions for a living. I have a job at one of the only places you can do impressions for a living.
Right. But also, it's also something
it has
about...
to be here because people are on their phones or they're crazy.
Right.
But everyone's always shouting while they're walking. And so you hear it all day.
But the nature of how you do it, you know, which is, it's just sort of like this, you just kind of like drop into the collective consciousness of this thing, you know, like, and you just
like
kind of run with it.
Like a police scanner or something.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, not, you know, it's, I don't think most impressionists have that. I think your approach to it is different. But let's go back. So.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm repeating this Christian comedian's act.
Yeah.
And my dad asked me, hey, do you want to do some comedy at this next event at the college?
Yeah.
He was the dean of students at the time.
At your college?
At the college I eventually went to, but it's the one that my dad worked
the
at.
The Nazarene College.
At the Nazarene College. I'm 14.
Yeah.
It's a singing competition. They have to count the votes for the singers.
And they need a little filler?
They need a little filler. And I did 10 minutes. I was 14. I have a tape of it somewhere. I can't find it. But
Brad Stein stuff?
No, this was me. I said, I'm going to write my own jokes.
Yeah.
And I guess 30 minutes before it, I wrote my own material. But it was like what a kid likes in stand. Like, isn't it weird when you go over to your friend's house and it smells weird? You know, like, what is a 14-year-old's observational comedy? And then I finished it by doing, like, one of the most, like, alt comedy things I could do ever in my comedy, which was, like, I did, you know, the robots at Chuck E. Cheese that would play the birthday song. You know, you go to Chuck E. Cheese and there's like the robot band, you know?
I've never been in one, but I...
You know what I'm talking about, right? The Rock of Fire Explosion or some of these little amusement places have these robot bands that lip sync a song.
Right.
So I did an impression of those bands, like of those robotic band members, but the song was Another Brick in the Wall Part 2. And that's how I closed, was like, all in all, you just... And I'm like... herky jerky movements like I'm playing the drums, and
which gives it a darkness and a weight.
That's what I'm saying is like a 14-year-old doing that. I look back on it and I'm like, I would be weird about doing that at UCB now.
Right.
I would be like, are they going to appreciate this?
Right.
does this translate?
It does. Of course it would.
So I'm proud of myself that I had those instincts. And then of course, you know, I would try comedy 4 or 5 times a year for the next like 5 years
at Zany's
and do terribly. I didn't start going up at Zany's until I was about 19 in college, but you know, I'd perform wherever, talent shows and to a boat one time, just like anywhere where I could find a way to do it.
And so then, you kept trying but not
doing well at all. The first time it went so good, and then it was terrible every other time.
In front of real audiences.
In front of real people. And
but you kept at it, or you were like fighting but in the meantime you're acting, you're a big actor in Christian propaganda movies.
I wouldn't say big, but I was always working on these skills, and like I was the kid in college or high school where kids would be like, oh, he's trying to be funny, but he's not funny. That's not funny.
It's funny because Chad Ryden was like, oh, he's been funny since he was 12. but did you know those guys? Were you hanging around comics early on?
Yeah, like I would say about at 19, that's when I started sneaking into bars to do bar comedy in Nashville. Because I knew that I just couldn't do the Christian comedy thing. I couldn't just perform in mega churches and
church
camps and stuff.
But this was also after the propaganda realization. This was after the...
Yeah, I'm coming out of that, and... This is embarrassing. I'll tell you, and we all have our ways into things. I saw Judd Apatow's Funny People.
Yeah.
And I saw this movie where young comics were in LA trying to get up at the improv.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I can just Google where to do stand-up in Nashville.
Yeah.
I found NashvilleStandUp.com, which was Chad Ryden's website.
Okay.
I found like a calendar of places. And one by one, I started sneaking out. My college had a thing... I signed a document saying I wouldn't even put myself in the presence of alcohol. I won't even go to bars. I can't go to somewhere that serves
alcohol.
Were
you afraid of that? I mean, like, because you signed it, were you abiding by it?
I wanted to be a good boy.
Yeah.
My dad worked at the college. I have this legacy of family. I'm like Nazarene royalty.
Yeah.
I can't embarrass everyone.
I guess on some level in that light, you know, Nashville is a relatively small town. You could get caught.
I could get caught because there were legends of, you know, certain deans driving around at the popular bars looking for kids.
Yeah.
So I was one by one ticking off which bars I could get into without getting carded because I'm, you know, underage.
Yeah.
And then Chad saw what I was doing and he started sort of ushering me into some of these bars to be on the lineup.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't drink at these places. I didn't drink underage. I got the X on my hand at the places that did the X's on the hands.
Yeah.
And that's how I started performing. I'm a good 20 years younger than everyone else doing comedy in Nashville.
Do you remember who they were?
Brad Edwards was my favorite comedian in Nashville. I don't know if you've seen him recently. He's really into woodworking.
Okay.
These days.
That's where he ended up.
But he was incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible comedian. I hope he still gets up. Sean Parrott is an incredible comedian in Nashville.
Uh-huh. Killer Bees?
Killer Bees. I never got to know Killer Bees very well. I would go to Zany's.
Better save up.
Save up. James Gregory.
Yeah.
You know, seeing all those guys, like Zany's was this other thing that none of us could break into. All the open micers, we were doing these like bar shows.
Yeah.
And Zany's was this thing that let in like one person every 4 years. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
Be a part
for
of
the
it.
Locals
for the locals, you know, to be. They had the sexy guitar comic, they had the cute guy who did guitar comedy, they had the, you know, they had a the fat guy who talked about going to McDonald's,
yeah,
and then whoever the touring guys were, those are the guys that would open for Nick Cannon,
right,
and
yeah,
James Gregory.
It's so funny, it's all Louis. This basic commedia dell'arte structure. There's
yeah,
this,
right?
this handful of types
uh-huh.
that just refill
uh-huh.
you know, if the fat guy dies, we got one waiting.
Yeah, we got the next guy. And
Ralphie's gone. Bring in the next heavyweight.
Bring in the next heavyweight. Yeah. Oh, he was just in a horrible car wreck and in the middle of nowhere yeah. doing some one-nighter.
Yeah.
Like comedy just I grew up in Nashville, the comedy scene seemed so dangerous. It seemed so it just was so unlike the safe sort of Christian world that I think.
And also unlike the Apatow movie on some level, you know, the sort of nuts and bolts of regional and road comedy.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like show business.
No, it doesn't.
And, you know, it's really just, it is what it is. But you
And it will be the exact same after the apocalypse.
Sure.
Nothing will change about it.
Sure. There'll be people going like, where is that club open? Or is it
a guy, a comedian with an arm sticking out of his forehead
yeah.
with like green ooze coming out of one eye.
I got a hook.
Yeah. I'm actually doing quadrant zone A4 tomorrow.
Yeah. It's great. And they'll let you eat for free. When did you decide, like the acting thing, did you just learn on the job, did you study it, or
I never really took any formal training. It was just like they both just happened, you know. Stand-up was this thing where there wasn't an improv scene in Nashville, which I may have done if I was in Chicago or something. So stand-up just became I have to perform somewhere, and that's how I got doing stand-up mostly. And I didn't do any impressions in my stand-up almost ever until maybe the last 4 or 5 years, probably.
Really?
Yeah, I just didn't really do it. I would do like one line as Louis.
Yeah.
You know, I would do, I would finish a 5 minute showcase set in LA. You know, I was in LA for the last 10 years. I would finish a showcase set by like doing Louis, like Born Again Louis C.K.
Oh, yeah. How's that feel?
Yeah. Do you ever go outside and the sky is blue and that's enough? You ever have that moment with your creator, however you define that presence in your that's amazing. I think Jesus is great, and I think the devil is a cunt. And
how did that do?
It would do well. I mean, that was the lesson, was like people didn't, after a certain point, to distinguish yourself from all of the, there's 1,000 comedians in LA, and to distinguish yourself you have to start making moves other, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and the impressions thing was a thing only I could do. Not everyone else was doing that. And I was like, if I can find a way to do impressions that's not corny, that is not Branson, Missouri, that is not Vegas. Then
well, there's only ever been a handful of people that do it professionally that you know.
Right.
Or well.
Yeah.
You know, there was a time in the 80s, I think, where everybody had one or two, where that's where you get that Hack Nicholson trip. But in terms of people that really can do it and be impressive, there's only been like a handful ever.
Yeah.
And it's a real sort of pocket of stand-up and show business. But it, like you said, it's hard to do. And even some great impressionists are not that great, but there's something about, they get one thing right.
It's hard to do it cool. It's hard to do it in a way that doesn't make you roll your eyes. I mean, I was a comedy fan.
Yeah.
And when there would be an impressionist would come up, if I'm watching a show, I would get like scared, because I'm like, either this is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be really kind of uncomfortable and sad. You know, like, because it can be. Yeah.
I remember growing up watching Rich Little. I mean, he was the guy.
Yeah.
Right. And then there was a from the generation before him, I think there were a lot more impressionists around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, like, you know, when you get sort of into the history of show business, I remember when I was a kid, you'd see Rich Little, and then you'd see these old guys on these talk shows, and someone was like, you know, Frank Gorshin was an impressionist. And I'm like, who the fuck is Frank Gorshin? This guy plays the Joker on the Batman show. Like, I'm not that old, but right. like I remember hearing that information, and then you get sort of fascinated with it. But
I think it comes from a nightclub tradition, right?
Yes.
Where you have a song, you have your jokes.
Yeah.
You know, everyone did everything.
Yes. At the variety thing,
yeah, before like before there were comedy clubs, before like Bud Friedman and stuff, there wasn't just a place that was just the stand-up.
No, you're opening
you had to
for
do
music.
It all.
Yeah.
And Margaret's doing stand-up and then singing a song in Tahoe. Like, yeah.
That was the one thing I always used to notice about Dana Gould. I'm like, he does it all.
Oh, I love Dana.
He's the best.
He's so funny.
He's so funny, but he can do all of it.
Funny forever.
Yeah.
That's what makes this week is Martin Short and Steve Martin at the show.
On SNL.
And Martin Short was like my number one.
Oh yeah.
When I got hired at SNL, they were like, "Well, what do you want to do? Like, what's your career?" And I was like, "I want to be Martin Short. I want to be funny for 50 years straight." And like you're undeniable.
Yes.
And that's
and the business does not know what to do with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's to me the business is being on every talk show, murdering.
Yeah.
And then popping up as a French guy in a movie for 20 minutes for like 5 minutes or whatever.
So,
I think that is the height of being in this
in show business. I think you're right. As I hope that those talk shows live long enough to where you can fulfill that dream.
I hope SNL lives long enough. That's
well, you're good. It's not going to go anywhere right away.
I'm not saying like that's going to happen. I just mean when I look out at like the media landscape, I'm always like, well, what am I going to be doing in 2 years?
Yeah,
like
where am I going to be doing it?
Where do I get to go next?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I want to do SNL as long as everyone gets to do SNL.
Yeah.
I want to do.
What are you on four now? 4 years?
This is my second season.
Second season.
And I want to do it for forever, you know?
Okay. So you're in Nashville. You're bordering on being at least a lapsed Christian in behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're doing stand-up, so where do you get the wherewithal just to go to L.A.? Do you meet somebody?
Let's see. Because Nashville comics would always go to Chicago.
But when I met you, so you hadn't left yet.
I hadn't left yet.
And you sat in a hotel room with me and Singer, and I recorded an intro?
Yes. You recorded an intro, and then we went to Pied Piper for some ice cream, I think.
Oh,
and we went to Grimey's, I think, to look at records.
Grimey's, yeah. We had
a
full day.
Store. We had a full Nashville day.
Were you talkative?
I think I said one joke to try to like get the respect, and I was like, I was not mature enough to be like, just ride out a nice day with Mark. Don't bother the guy. Precious had just come out.
Yeah.
This is the worst joke of all time.
Yeah.
Somebody brought up Precious.
Yeah.
From the back of the car, I said, Eddie Murphy can do anything. And it did not get that response last time.
Damn it.
So I think you went, ha.
Yeah, it was me. It was me, you, and Singer driving
around. Oh, man. So that was like, well, I got to try.
Yeah, it was good.
You got to cast your lot.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I didn't
don't apologize for that. Mark, do you understand that those are the moments that lead to me be achieving some sort of greatness?
Oh, good. All
it's
right.
Like wanting to get the kill in the car.
Glad to help out.
Visiting comic.
Yeah. Did you do that with a lot of visiting comics?
Oh, not really. I didn't hang out with it because a lot of them weren't the guys I was fans of.
Yeah.
It was like there was a couple years where I saw a lot of the people that I liked.
Yeah.
I saw you. I saw Louis. I saw Patton.
Yeah.
Todd Barry. I saw Reggie Watts.
Yeah.
I saw Conan.
Right.
Like I had this like great little run in 2009 to 2011 where I got to, that was at the beginning of my open micing.
Yeah.
And I really got to see great acts,
that came
through Nashville.
And then you moved to LA.
And then I in college I got to go for a semester to LA.
Yeah.
To be in some film school program for a semester.
What'd you do there?
It was like a Christian college thing where they had like a semester exchange where you could go learn some video production in LA and intern. I interned at Beavis and Butthead. I interned for Mike Judge for like a little one season reboot of Beavis and Butthead.
He's a good guy.
He is a good guy. I really respect him.
Yeah.
He's a Southerner who figured out how to do intelligent, you know, King of the Hill is an achievement.
Yeah.
King of the Hill is an achievement. To take Texas people, believably render real feeling Texas people, and do it in a way that's respectful and honest at the same time.
Yeah,
like you show their faults, you show their compassion.
Yeah,
you don't hate Hank at all. You respect Hank.
Empathetic treatment of
like a group that usually gets shit on all the time.
Yeah.
And So I loved that I got to work for Mike Judge for a little bit. That felt very appropriate. But then I got bad grades because I was just doing open mics all the time. And I came back to Nashville.
In L.A.
In L.A. And
where at? Like Nerdist and all that shit?
Yeah, I would go to
Meltdown. All places?
Yeah, Meltdown. And I would go to Holy Fuck every Tuesday. Yeah. That show in the theater, the movie theater.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you ever
do
Dave Ross's movie theater
show? I did
show?
Do that. Yeah, downtown, right?
Downtown.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would Meltdown, Power Violence, and go to hang out at the Improv.
Power Violence on, what was it, on like Mel or Santa Monica?
Yeah, that was still in that little theater.
Who the fuck was that? Was that Josh
Thomas?
Whit Thomas.
Whitmer Thomas.
Sure. And wasn't it two guys hosting it? And wasn't it kind of chaotic?
It was very chaotic.
I remember doing it once, and I'm like, what the fuck is happening?
Well, you would see like you or Bill Burr, or like you would see real comedians.
We were all willing to try.
Do this punk show, you know, and so LA had these good little $5 or free shows that I could see real comedians at, and so I would hang out at all those, and I was starting to get booked, but then I chickened out, went back to Nashville, did comedy in Nashville for 2 more years, met the woman who is now my wife, and then I moved back to LA for 10 years.
What's she do?
She is a counselor. She is a therapist.
Oh, really?
She's in college. She's in grad school to be a therapist. But,
oh, that's good.
She's worked in behaviorism and
worked
at schools with like kids smearing shit on the walls. And
so you're covered.
I'm covered.
You're gonna managed.
Found the one that is gonna be able to ride this out, however long it lasts for me,
and be helpful.
And be helpful, and also be hate it. At the correct degree.
Yeah.
Hate it to a healthy degree.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
So you just go on your own, you just pack up and say, I'm going, Ma.
I'm going out this time. I think I had like $1,000 or something from some.
And your parents all along the way are okay. Commercial. They believe that you're going to maintain your decency.
You know, to their credit, they let me go.
Yeah.
But from my perspective, I also believe that they were positive that I would
fail.
Come home soon and teach poetry at a small private Christian college.
Yeah.
And be a respectable man.
Poetry.
Even after I'm like, I remember I had booked a Coen Brothers movie. I had 2 lines in a Coen Brothers movie, and I told my grandparents, and my grandpa was like, well, you'll come home, you'll teach history.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm in a Coen Brothers movie.
They don't know.
Papa. They don't know.
But that, which movie? Hail Caesar, right?
Hail Caesar, yeah.
What a great movie. I love that celebrate movie. That movie. And you know, and people will not join me in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's one of the great Coen Brothers movies. But I guess everyone's kind of weird about Coen Brothers. They all have their, like, I'm not a Lebowski guy. I mean, I like it.
Yeah.
I've watched it many times, but I'm not in the cult.
You may be a Lebowski character.
That's
you may
true.
Be believable as another man at that bowling alley.
Yeah, I'm living that to a certain degree. We all are. I get the point of why it's so, why people love it. But for me, you know,
what's
Hail Caesar.
One?
And it, like a double feature of Hail Caesar and Barton Fink, I see Hail Caesar as the sequel to Barton Fink,
the light sequel to Barton Fink.
Right.
Well, it's literally the Capitol Pictures, the fake studio.
Yeah.
The Michael Lerner.
Yeah.
Studio. I remember sitting next to Joel Coen, who you could play in a film, and I was sitting next to Joel Coen, and I was like, I gotta talk to him.
Yeah.
And again, I'm too green. I should have shut the hell up and let
no, you got it,
the
dude.
Guy.
You just got to do
life.
It, dude.
So I'm sitting in a director's chair next to him. We're on location in Agua Dulce. We're in one of those movie ranches somewhere shooting the Western scene. And I see the Capitol Pictures logo on some old timey trucks in the way in the background of the shot. I was like, oh, Capitol Pictures from Barton Fink. That's pretty cool. And then Joel Coen, who is obviously thinking about the next sequence of shots that he's going to compose with Roger Deakins.
Yeah.
Like glances over distractedly and looks at him. And he's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like goes back to the important work that he's doing.
He acknowledged you got the,
and I felt like such a rat for bugging this artist.
Oh,
his,
come
in
on.
The middle of his work day.
Come on. What's my Coen Brothers movie? I think it changes over the years.
Yeah.
And I like Serious Man because as a Jew, it's such a Jewy movie.
Mm.
It's probably one of the Jewiest movies since Fiddler. And
it does start with a tale of a Dybbuk. Like it starts with like a folk tale.
Yeah, of the ghost. Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
Ghost.
Yeah.
And I see, as a somebody who grew up super Christian, I got a lot of value out of Serious Man. I'm watching it and I'm like, oh yeah, the bonds that tie you to the entire history of your traditions, of your like family's traditions.
Well, you know, a lot of Christians are very pro-Jew. But it sadly, it's
to a degree.
No, but it's an apocalyptic vision.
I know. I talk about this with my Jewish comedy writer friends now, where we're like,
yeah, when you get us all to Israel, then Jesus could come back.
So, exactly right.
I get it,
but it doesn't end well for
no.
For one half of the equation.
Well, I've been playing with these ideas about how, you know, I haven't really, I connect them sometimes when I'm riffing, but the idea that, like, if you believe in Jesus, you'll probably believe anything. I mean, you have to sort of, like, manage that door.
Right.
Because there's not, like, you know, the spectacular sort of mythology of it enables QAnon to a certain degree.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I hang out with Christians and conservatives a fair amount because we're in Nashville all the time.
Now, right, and so you think that that's a faulty premise.
I just feel like I don't know a lot of the Q people or they're like hiding it, but I do know that Facebook has ruined so many people's brains.
Yeah.
Like there is like a thing now where people are quick to believe the thing with the fewest sources.
Right.
And quick to negate a very thoroughly well-researched, like, New Yorker article
is, you just explained religion.
I know. See, I think that's the thing that's ultimately keeps me from re-engaging with Christianity. You know,
but you can have faith, and you can have belief,
Know if I do. I don't know if I believe the stuff.
But you've grown to be more forgiving and accepting of the community that you came up
in. I think religion is beautiful. I think if you can actively engage in it and it makes you, I've seen it make people's lives better.
Yeah.
But I had this intense respect for religion and I followed the teachings of Christianity very closely and I had respect for it. It was that respect that led me away from it because I came to a point where I was in an argument with a pastor friend.
Yeah.
A really enlightened guy, cool, like, well-read, you know, a liberal thinker in the true sense of the word. And I'm, like, talking to him about this stuff, and I'm saying just some stuff I casually believe, and he's just like, yeah, well, I mean, Jesus did rise from the dead. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I believe the stuff. Like, it just hit me that I'm maybe not a Christian because you have to believe the stuff.
Yeah.
And I think I just realized maybe as soon as like 5 years ago or something, I was like, I don't think I believe the stuff.
Yeah.
And then that made me go, well, I've got to stop faking that I believe the stuff.
Right.
Because this is disrespectful to people who do.
Right.
And so that's where I'm at with it now.
Okay.
Where we have this little baby and we're like, are we going to raise him?
With the stuff?
With the stuff. Because, you know, and I'm like, he's got to know the Jonah and the whale.
Yeah, right.
He's got to know the stories.
But that's the old stuff.
He's got to know the tales. But I just don't want him growing up with crazy baggage and guilt guiding him through everything. I was a virgin until I was 25, you know?
It must have been a good day.
It was
okay.
First two times were not, they were C minuses on my end of the bargain. But the third and fourth time was like hearing the Beatles for the first time, for sure.
Oh, good.
But, you know, I don't want my kid growing up afraid of engaging with the world.
Right.
I mean, Christianity can do that to you, where you're like, you grow up thinking that everything that is not Christian is pure evil.
Right.
And I want to have a love of discovery, a curiosity.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah, the people that live in that 5-square-mile radius that you're talking about, I think it was the lack of curiosity that terrified me about living
and they're
way.
And they're enforcing of that the enforcing of, like, what you said, like, everything that's you know, that we don't understand has got to be bad.
And now it's, and now living in the country is sort of a virtual experience. Like, we live in a monoculture, we have the internet, all of us live in the same culture at the same time.
Yeah, but no one's on the same page of the internet.
I know. So, that is true.
But
that is true.
The okay, so you're out there. You did the Coen Brothers movies, and you're showing up on things. So when does the big break come? Because you're not really. Are you working as a touring comic?
I'm like, I wouldn't say I'm featuring, working. I'm like featuring for like Ryan sometimes, or like Dave Stone, or, you know, Rory maybe once or twice, or so doing a Go Bananas weekend with somebody else making $500
right in Cincinnati.
In Cincinnati, and you know,
Jeff Tate.
These are men that helped me out. Kyle Kinane.
Yeah.
So So I'm going around with these guys sometimes and trying to learn stuff. At some point I got an agent and I got JFL in 2017.
Is it interesting though that these guys, so you held out, you were hanging out and, with some, fairly sweet demons.
Yeah.
And I imagine they kind of took care of your sensibility. They were not like, what's up, dude? You gonna do this?
Yeah. No, these are guys that read books and also are looking for fried chicken at every moment of the day.
Yeah. You know, and drinking.
I mean? And drinking beer. So I was able to engage with guys that were like, oh, they're half in my Tennessee world somehow. Yeah. And they're half in this punk comedy world too.
Yeah.
And that was a good bridge from my like Christian comedy world.
Nice.
To
those are good guys.
To the city.
Those are all good guys. And, Jeff and Ryan and Kyle.
I owe them so much. And and so at some point I got an agent in LA and managers.
JFL.
I did JFL. I remember I went into JFL thinking this is where the SNL people see you. I got to do my SNL set. So my 5 minutes at JFL was like an SNL audition. I did Louie. I sang a song. I did like a sportscaster bit. I did one-liners. I had all. And
did
I didn't
kill.
I had a kill. I got written up on some comedy blog. I was like, this is a good JFL. I didn't have a single meeting. I didn't talk to anybody. Yeah. No call from SNL.
Yeah.
You know what I think it is?
Yeah.
And I don't mind saying this on WTF. What I think it was is Sam J. I had to follow Sam J every stage of JFL. Sam J, just this murderer. You know Sam J.
Sure.
Just a murderer.
Yeah.
And she would level the theater.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, she was hired to SNL writing staff. Like that night of our big JFL show.
Right.
I swear to God, SNL was just talking to her already backstage. I don't think they were watching my set because she was like crushing.
Oh, that's probably true.
I think that may have been what happened.
They just ran backstage right when you got up. Whoever brought you up, they were already backstage talking to Sam.
Not that it's a guarantee that I was going to get SNL at that point. And thank God that it didn't. I'm so glad that it happened 5 years later when I was in my 30s and not my single in my mid-20s.
It took 5 years. So what are you doing for that 5 years? When do you start doing Trump on whatever Instagram?
I got together with my former girlfriend, who's my wife now. We got together again after 5 years apart. I was happy. I went to therapy.
This is the 5-year interim.
This is the 5-year interim.
And SNL.
I started going to therapy. Yeah. I made up with my family.
How deep was that riff?
It wasn't that much of a riff, but it was all on me. It was all this like, this stuff.
They didn't even know, really.
They barely even knew. Yeah. They didn't know that I was on Prozac and I had anxiety and I had all this. So I think it was just I worked on myself and I like kept plugging away at stand-up. I started a show in Highland Park at a bar called L'Aquavita, Little Cave.
Uh-huh.
We started a show called Rod Stewart Live.
Yeah. Didn't do that one.
You
didn't ask me.
I don't think you would have wanted to do this one because we had to pummel our way through to the laughs. I mean, it was a loud biker cocaine bar.
Oh, wow.
That is.
Why'd you choose that place?
That is a goth bar because they would let us.
Oh, yeah.
They would let us do the show. And for 5 years.
Where is it?
Every Wednesday night. It's at, where Triple Beam Pizza is and Hippo?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like right next to that.
Okay.
And so I kind of did roadhouse comedy in Highland Park every Wednesday night for 5 years.
While you were going to therapy,
being in love and doing commercial auditions for Taco Bell and stuff.
Ugh.
And that's, I think, really where I got my stand-up chops, finally, was fighting through conversations and getting the attention of people. And that's where I started doing Trump on stage.
Okay.
The first couple times I did Trump in 2018, 2017... impression was okay, and people would stop and listen because it kind of sounds like him. But I'm doing the angry, I'm a liberal, and I'm doing the angry Trump. We're going to kill everybody, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And not getting laughs, but they are quiet. And I was like, I never want that. I never want to silence a biker bar and not get laughs.
Yeah.
So that's when I started abstracting the Trump, and I made him like a guy from Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And then like that's where it took on the thing that it is now, where... I remember being
you can talk
like,
about anything.
And I would just do like that's like a guy from medieval times.
Yeah.
Like he's like trying to scare peasants. And so then I would be like, we've got to do something about the Mermaid King. The Mermaid King. By the way, only I have the amulet.
that will allow me to breathe underwater and defeat this mermaid king. Wouldn't it be great if we got along with the dragons? So by abstracting it and making it silly, then I started getting laughs with it and getting confident with it. And then COVID happened. We lost our show. We're all stuck in our houses. My wife and I had a miscarriage. We were bummed out.
You got married during that time?
We got married in 2018, and then COVID happened. We were trying to have a kid. Yeah. We lost the pregnancy. Yeah.
Sorry.
Happens to everybody. We were just depressed in our home, and I just started making videos for Twitter, just walking around my house because I had to do comedy somehow.
Yeah, that's what I did with Instagram, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it, everyone kind of started doing that a little bit because there was nowhere to perform.
Yeah.
And it was an election year, and my Trump impression was something silly that didn't piss people off. It was like a release.
Yeah.
And they just started getting picked up and getting shared by celebrities, and at some point. And then I started a podcast where with my buddy Zach Pugh. And on this podcast, What Things Are What Things, I would do like, I would call in as a celebrity at the end for like 20 minutes and be Bob Dylan or be Bobby Flay or Joe
You'd
Biden.
Do Bobby Flay?
I would do Bobby Flay, yeah.
What is that?
Like, that's it. Now stick around because there's going to be a lot more ribs where that came from right after this. You know how like Bobby has like the TV Bobby?
Yeah.
Where he's reading a cue card? Yeah. He's really excited and he's speaking at a huge volume.
Yeah.
And he's a little New York. He's kind of not ready to be on TV, but it's not like he's going to take any elocution classes or anything like that. But he's excited to make a brick oven pizza. And then there's the cutaway where he's sort of snidely explaining what a red sauce is, because Food Network is for people who've been hit in the head 20 times.
Yeah.
So he's like, well, you know, a red sauce is, you know, usually composed of diced onion, a little bit of garlic, and San Marzano tomatoes is sort of packaged at the peak of their freshness, and I just kind of want to start sweating all the aromatics and get that started in the saucepan. He has like the quiet, shy guy in the cutaway. Yeah, yeah. And then the big theater kid who can't wait to show you how Guy Fieri makes his ultimate barbecue queso.
Yeah.
So I would do Bobby Flay a lot and Trump a lot. Yeah. And the big clip that took off for me that I think got me on SNL was I did Trump pretending to be a New York comedian in the 2000s, remembering how good the Rafifi scene was.
Oh my God, it's pretty specific.
So that was an episode Whitmer Thomas was on, and that's just how the conversation ended up. And Whitmer was like, well, Trump, you were in the New York comedy scene around that time. And then I was like, the whole clip is just like, oh yeah, it was me, it was Burr, it was Patrice, and you know who we all thought was amazing was A.D. Miles. We loved A.D. Miles and Tisdale.
Tisdale.
So that clip, I think, somehow like Seth Meyers and John Mulaney and a few of those guys like it ended up on their group chat. And
oh, so that's interesting because because those are the guys who were in on the inside.
Yeah.
And they were kind of locked into that world, right?
Yeah, they were kind of coming up around the time of Burr and Patrice. And
yeah,
everybody.
Sure. And Rafifi.
And so that clip got passed around. And I think it was like, oh, he's good at impressions and he has like a knowledge of comedy. He's obviously like a comedy fan. And so when I sent in a tape, when I got invited to send in a tape to SNL, almost a year later, they watched it and I watched them watch it. I watched the view count on it. It was like a private tape. So like when you send a link and you send it a private link to your Vimeo or
YouTube.
Oh, is
that how it works?
Yeah. You can see if no one has the link, no one's watching it except for the people you sent it to.
Right.
So I just watched it get watched like a dozen times 1 week. And I was like, oh, they're watching it at SNL.
You were just kind of checking it every other day or?
My agents would tell me. I was trying to forget about it. I was like trying to get jobs and I was like, this isn't going to happen. Honey,
a year
it's
later.
Not going to happen.
Yeah.
This is at least 6 months after I made these clips.
Okay.
Whenever it was hiring time, you know, they start watching tapes in July or something like that. And I was like, honey, it's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. Cause we're already pregnant. We're already nesting in LA.
Yeah.
We're in Highland Park. We got a good condo.
Yeah.
I've got my little routine. I film a couple self-tape auditions. I grab my Kindle. I go down to the pool. I read my Keith Richards book.
Great book.
And it's a great one.
And I go back upstairs and we eat dinner. And I was like, I had a great life where I was making 30, 40 grand a year as an actor once or twice a year.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm acting one little thing. And I'm in the background of a George Clooney Nespresso commercial.
Yeah.
And, oh, it's playing in Germany now. So I think we can go on that, you know, we can go to that wedding or whatever.
Nice, yeah.
So that's how I'm taking care of things. And I was like, honey, SNL, it's not going to happen.
But are you miserable? You're okay.
We were so happy. That's why we got pregnant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we were truly happy. And making little videos. I'm doing Trump and Jeff Goldblum on Cameo.
Yeah.
People buy my cameos, and I'm just famous enough on the internet that I can be on Cameo and sell a $100 cameo of me doing, well, happy birthday to a very beautiful person.
Yeah.
You know, my terrible Goldblum and stuff. And then they invited me, they saw the tape, and they invited me to audition in L.A., and I was on a job. I was shooting an Adam Conover Netflix show, so I had to drive back from Santa Clarita to make it to the SNL audition.
Everything shoots in Santa Clarita. There's always
don't know why.
It's wild, right?
That's where they shoot everything. I know. And I had to haul ass in my 30-year-old truck to make it to WeHo for my call time, a fully COVID locked down Groundlings Theater, where they're having this showcase. There's 20 people on it. Me and Sarah Squirm are on it. I don't know if you know her, but she got hired my same year. She's a great comic. And I was like, honey, don't worry about it. I'm going to do well, but it's not going to lead to anything. SNL jerks all my friends around. We all go up three times in front of them and none of us get hired. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's a good thing for a comic to end up in the casting mix for SNL, but it never happens.
Right.
So I'm just like telling her.
Who are those friends that you knew who've been run up the...
I felt like any friend of mine that was already doing cool things, like Wit was one of those guys who I knew had auditioned and came back. And, you know, I had friends that had gone and tested and just come back.
Yeah.
And it was like a thing. It's like a, like JFL, it's like a mark of success that you got in the mix.
Right.
I had a great set. I went up like fourth at this showcase and I just had a great set.
Yeah.
I did like 15 different people. I was like, my way into SNL is the characters and impressions. It's not just stand up.
Right.
So I was like, I'm not going to do stand up.
Right.
And so, I did Trump talking. I think my first thing was Trump saying happy birthday to Frankenstein at like some event.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He's a great guy. Look at him. Frankenstein. One of our favorite people, and he has beautiful bolts. I love the bolts. They're so beautiful. And he's so tall. You know, I was talking to Babadook, and our wives are friends, and Babadook is also tall. So that was the first thing. And then I did Lindsey Graham, Bobby Flay, Michael Rapaport. I did Chris O'Dowd.
What's your Rapaport?
These fucking guys with the spaghetti arms and the little chicken finger toes. Who always up at Starbucks.
Yeah.
You know, it's that. It's one volume.
Have you met many of the people that you do impressions of?
Mark, Mark, the other day I said goodbye to my wife. I headed into SNL. I lit a joint on the streets of New York. And I took one puff of it and almost ran into Michael Rapaport. He's holding a microphone. He's got some guy. He's going to make something for his Instagram like that. And I just got to talk to him for a second because he follows me.
Yeah.
He's like, I like how you do me, you know, and I'm like, I'm talking to him. Yeah, man. And they had Natasha doing me instead. And I was like, they got to let the James guy do it.
He's really
so
all
I,
right.
So I got to talk to him for 5 minutes and he's I just have this lit joint in my hand.
Yeah. You didn't want any?
I should have offered him some of my joints.
He's fun to be around.
I knew him from movies all growing up. He just seemed like so New York to me.
Totally. But he's like all lit up all the time.
He's always on.
Yeah. So, okay. So
I did all these things.
And you killed.
I had a great set. Yeah. And Sarah's backstage. Sarah Sherman is backstage. She's going to go on in a little bit. And she's like, I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know if I'm supposed to be here. And I was so full of that comedy juice.
Yeah.
This is COVID. We're not performing live a whole lot.
Yeah.
To get a kill in front of 30 people is like,
yeah.
I felt like I was on drugs or something. And I poured it all into Sarah. I was like, you are incredible. You are a performer. You're going to crush. I just gave her all of my like vibes. And then she crushed too, and we both got invited to New York. When I got the call that I was invited to New York, I'm like, honey, it's not going to happen. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You're not going to have to move. Just, I said, go to Nashville, hang out with your mom. I'll meet you.
Yeah.
We'll cool off from the disappointment of not getting the show.
Yeah.
That was the plan.
Yeah.
And I went up to New York. The first day was the,
In studio
thing.
Yeah.
And, I was a little nervous about it. My dad gives me these unhelpful baseball metaphors all the time.
Yeah.
I don't watch a lot of baseball. I love going to it live, but I don't know what any of the stats mean.
Yeah.
I wish I did.
Yeah.
I'd love to be a sports guy. But my dad always gives me these baseball metaphors, and they always help, even though I don't have a tangible attachment to baseball.
Yeah.
But his thing is always like, if I have a big show, he gives me the same speech where he's like, you know, the great hitters, you know, they're not swinging all the way through. It's right before that ball makes contact with the bat. You let up just a little bit, and it's that little bit of give that knocks it out of the park.
Right.
That's, you want it to have a little bit of that flexibility.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the tests are on the home base, you know, where Tom Hanks stands and says, we have a great show. Hubba Stank is here. That's Zach Galifianakis's joke.
Yeah.
I just remember I was like, oh, they'll give me a moment. So my heart's slamming, but I took a moment to like do breathing exercises and come down. So I think I took 30 seconds to.
While you were standing there?
I'm standing there and I just go. I'm like counting in 4 and breathing out 8.
Yeah.
Like the things that my therapist taught me about making it through bumpy flights.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing bumpy flight breathing.
Yeah.
And I came down enough and then I just jumped into the Trump stuff. I did the exact same audition I did in L.A., and everybody told me they weren't going to laugh. They laughed the whole time. As soon as they were laughing, I was like so relieved. You know, by the end of it, I'm doing Willie Nelson. And
so Lauren's there and everybody?
Lauren's there and everybody. It's so weird. The camera's dead on.
Yeah.
You're supposed to play to the camera.
Yeah.
Stage manager standing next to the camera. All the writers and producers are way over in a corner to your left.
Yeah.
And I think it's like possibly is like a performance test to see if you're going to end up playing to the live audience.
Right.
Or if you're going to play to the camera.
Right.
And you're supposed to play to the camera.
Yeah.
And not get distracted that all of the laughers are over here.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's part of their psychology of this process.
Yeah.
But I had heard from, I think Hannah Einbinder told me play to the camera because she had auditioned the year before. And so I gave it all to camera. That was the right move. It went great. That night, I got a call to meet producers. And the next day, you know, there's like a group of us waiting in the writer's room and we're all getting like called off to different offices. And I met Lauren pretty quickly. It's like maybe my second meeting was with Lauren.
Yeah.
And
did you have to wait to meet Lauren?
I didn't have to wait very long. Wow. He made me wait in the middle of it. I got called in. He talked to me for about 10 minutes. And then it was like he sort of like, you know, and it's the Lorne way where he's kind of like a sphinx a little bit.
Yeah.
He's like speaking in kind of temple riddles,
uh-huh.
like a Zelda boss or something.
Yeah.
So like I come in and he's walking to his desk and he's like, oh, well, we were in New Mexico and Will Ferrell, excuse me, Forte, showed me one of your videos and we were having a good time watching it. And like that's like that's sort of like the the Lorne hello have a seat and all that. And so I was like, this guy has a vibe. This guy has a way he does these meetings.
Yeah,
his whole job is meetings with people, with artists.
Yeah,
so I'm like, it was just surreal. It was very surreal
because
you hear everybody's story about meeting Lorne. So, and then halfway through it, he was like telling me some historical anecdote or something like that, where I think I was just making conversation with him about, I had just been in Montreal. I knew he was Canadian. So I was like, do you like Montreal? Do you like Quebec? He's like, well, I like Quebec City a great deal. And he starts looking at his phone. There's a hotel there. He's just looking at his phone that looks out on a field looks at the phone a little bit closer, where the British defeated the French. This is the network. I have to take this. And he sent me a, he sent me out, and I think I stood outside of his office for 25 minutes or so while I talked to the president of
NBC
of the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I got called back in, and you know, he was like, "Well, the purpose of these meetings is to see if you're funny. I think you're funny. You'll be wearing a lot of wigs. You'll get used to it very quickly. You're seasoned, so I'm not really worried about you. Are you married?" I was like, "Yes, I'm married." He's like, "Children?" I said, "I have, we're 5 months pregnant." He's like, "When's your baby due?" And I said, "Christmas Eve." And he like looked at the calendar on the wall of all the, when the shows are.
Yeah.
He's like, "Well, you have a show on the 18th and then you'll have a little bit of a break and you'll have the baby on the break." And like, I'm washing my hands in the bathroom after that. And I'm just like, "Oh, is that it? Is that the show? Like, I'm on SNL now and I have to call Becca and tell her, like, you are moving.
Yeah.
At the height of your pregnancy, you will be in a dead winter in New York.
Yeah.
In the first apartment we could find.
Yeah.
And we will deliver a baby halfway through, like, the most intense work period of my career."
Yeah. How'd that land?
So I was still afraid of flying. So I took an Amtrak, a 24-hour Amtrak to Birmingham to go back to the South.
Oh, you have this horrendous fear of flying?
I did. I think show business has thoroughly beaten it out of me now. Now I love it. Now I really enjoy
it. You relax into it.
Well, I get to go on first class now sometimes. Yeah, so, sure. You know, the champagne and the reading the book and looking at the clouds. Now I love it. And also I've just, you know, I try to work through try to face the stuff that scares me and work through the stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
no control over it.
Yeah, and it's just like, oh.
You don't know how to fly a plane.
I don't know how to fly a plane. And if I die, that's awesome.
Sure.
Then I get to die.
Yeah.
Then I never have to worry about stuff. I'm a dead guy.
Yeah, maybe I'll get there. That seems like a good way to look at it.
Let's do mushrooms sometime and talk to death. But there was some fear still in me that I had to get on the trip. I think I wanted to just veg out and not think and talk to anyone.
Right.
I had just done...
You needed some time.
I needed some time. I had just done this Netflix show. I had, in between the Netflix show and getting this SNL audition, had gone to New York separately to play Donald Trump in the Carey Mulligan movie that just came out, the She Said.
Yeah.
You know, She Said about Harvey Weinstein investigators. Yeah.
So I got to see that. Is it out yet?
It's out, yeah. And I guess I'm still in it as Trump over the phone.
Okay.
But they wanted me as a live actor screaming at Carey Mulligan. This is a drama Trump. This is not a comedy Trump.
Right.
And so to have done that already and then get invited to come back to New York to audition for SNL was just so strange.
Yeah.
So I think I had just gone back and forth doing all these things, and I just had this really intense period of my career that felt really intense to me at the time. And I wanted to be alone. I was on an Amtrak train, 24 hours, coach, no sleeper. No sleeper.
Yeah.
Just sitting there staring.
Yeah.
And I was like, they didn't call. Sarah got the call. They hadn't called me. And I was like, maybe I didn't get the show. I never got the official pickup call.
Right.
And halfway through this Amtrak train, I got the Lorne Michaels call, and they had gotten I think I had written my number down wrong on the contact sheet when I got to New York.
Yeah.
So they had left a voicemail on some other Tennessean's cell phone.
Yeah.
So I got the call. I talked to him. He was like, "Where are you?" I was like, "I'm on an Amtrak train." He goes, "Oh, what a glamorous life you lead." I immediately called my wife afterward and told her, and she just sobbed hard. It was just like, just ugly sobbing.
Yeah.
And I came back, and it was just like, she was just like, "I knew it was going to happen. I was dreading it the whole time."
Dreading that it would?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Because we were very happy in LA, and we were nesting. She was nesting. She was building, and we had a closet with all of the baby cabinets. Everything was baby proof.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what she was grieving.
That you put all this work in. And
she had hormonal, nesting grief that her bird's nest was destroyed.
Right.
It was like her house was burned down to her.
Wow.
But I was like, I know this is hard for us right now, but like, this is how I feed us for the rest of our marriage. Like, even if I flame out spectacularly, even if I fuck everything up for us, and I'm an even if I become an absolute piece of shit,
yeah,
from now on, it'll say SNL in the corner of my poster, and some people will come to my show. I was like, even if I ruin our lives, well, I'll always be able to feed us, because that's what SNL does. It's like, I'll always be able to draw somewhat of a crowd,
right?
Because that's like, it's like the comedy Supreme Court or something. It's right. like the Olympics,
yeah,
of comedy for right. America.
But it's like, it's interesting that you saw it, you know, in relation to, you know, your life, that, you know, this is, you know, despite however we feel and whatever happens, this will provide for us.
I was fully in dad mode.
Yeah.
I was only thinking, I was only in the terrified pre-baby zone.
Right. That's probably the best zone to be in. Because it could have went selfish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
If I had gotten this job and I was 24 and just a psycho and single and stuff, I don't know that I'd be able to mentally be able to ride it.
But it's interesting. Your whole life prepares you, like, in terms of responsibilities and experience, even if it was with Christian Broadcasting and this or that, that by yeah. the time you get to this place, you're emotionally grounded, and professionally you've seen a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing intimidating about the situation other than the pace and the requirements.
Yeah, that's I had to learn all that on the job, how to, like, keep up with.
Yeah.
I mean, I had done jobs before, but it was like, as an actor, I was the 2 days on the courtroom show guy. You know what I
right.
mean? I'm lawyer with one line.
Yeah.
Number one.
You guy sitting in a trailer.
I'm a guy sitting in a trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reading a Stephen King book.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't used to the pace of SNL.
Sure.
That's really, I think, what prepares you for the rest of your career is doing SNL.
Yeah.
Like now I actually do have what I feel like the skill set and sturdiness to deliver.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure. In any situation.
In any showbiz situation.
Not going to be afraid anymore.
Not going to be afraid, and not going to get up in my head too much about something, because it's like, when you're waiting around all week for your show or your opportunity to get up there, you can stew about it and truly get yourself to the point where you're going to suck.
Yeah.
And SNL, you don't have the time to do anything but the first funny thing you think of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like if a writer comes into my office and says, "Can you do Eugene Levy?" I have 20 minutes to like get something together for the table read.
Yeah.
I can't worry about if it's not good enough.
Yeah.
And it's usually funnier that way. It's usually an impression is, I know this through SNL truly now, an impression is funnier if you like kind of grab it and just do your best with it rather than meticulously fine tune it over and over.
Well, and also but the thing that makes you gifted in that zone is what makes impressionists good or bad, is that you have this instinct about, you know, which beat of their being to hit.
To hit, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, that's the whole trick.
That's, I think, why Dana, even though Dana Carvey doesn't focus fully on sounding exactly like the person,
yeah,
Dana finds the joke in them so quickly
right,
and so
right.
spectacularly that I think that's what makes him the best. Like,
yeah,
they told me I was Biden the week I got there, and I had to do it the cold open of my first show, I was Biden.
Yeah.
And after I did it once, which was just like, I blacked out. I don't even remember it. I asked for Dana Carvey's number and I talked to him for an hour. And he just told me that's what that place is like. He's like, sometimes you just figure it out on the fly. You figure it out in front of everybody on TV. And my HW took me a year. I was doing it a lot. And I didn't know what to do. And he said, all the hands and the,
yeah,
you know, wouldn't be prudent. All of that stuff, he just found after doing it 20 times, you know?
Right.
And so that really calmed me down. And I was like, I'm going to find this Biden.
Yeah.
You know, I already knew kind of what I'd like to do as Trump. But Biden, to this day, is the one that each time I do it, I try something new. Because I want to kill with it.
Yeah. And how's it going?
You know, other people tell me I'm great at it. Yeah. I will never be happy with any of my work.
Ugh.
I'll never truly be chill about it.
Yeah.
I'll always go,
Yeah, no.
There was some.
I feel that sometimes.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I just did two shows last night, taping an HBO special, and today I'm like, did I?
Yeah.
Fuck.
You taped an HBO special
last night. Yeah.
And you can't just.
No,
love
because
it.
But yeah, but see, it's a similar thing that I realized too, is that like I've been doing these jokes for, you know, a year and a half now. Mm-hmm. So on a very basic level, it was another night of that.
Right.
And you know, like second show only because new things happened.
Yeah.
Like I had a little more looseness and things happened on stage that had never happened before. I feel good about that.
Yeah.
But it's just like, what was good about it? Like this one line, like it never right. was there.
And it'll never, and that should be a beautiful thing about it.
It is. No, I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. You beat yourself up.
You beat yourself up and truly the job is that show that night.
Yeah.
That's what scares me about doing a special myself is like, well, I'll never like it as much as looking back on my year and remembering that one time in Boston.
Yeah, where that
where
one
it
thing
felt
happened.
Kind of right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's weird though, but to find stuff in a high pressure situation, which you're doing all the time, mm-hmm. is very exciting.
It's really exciting, and yeah. there's something that removes that self-critical element from it, at least the negativity of it, to truly know like all I can do is the live show. The live show is really all it is.
Yeah.
And what happens at the live show is what it is.
Yeah.
And then that is that clip.
And they're taping it. You're lucky.
Yep, they're taping it. And you sort of release, you do get a release from the perfectionism.
Yeah.
You and also they're not gonna, the fans kind of don't like you like until they know you.
Yeah.
They're still getting to know you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like you can kind of be there and you're like listening when they're doing the opening credits and you hear who's getting screams on their names and you're like, they're just not going to scream at my name until they know me.
Right.
And they're still getting to know me. This is only.
Yeah. And you just got to accept that.
You just go like, I'm a part of an ensemble and at some point it won't be the third date anymore.
Yeah.
Second or third date. It'll be, they'll be married to me.
Yeah.
And they will just know.
Here he is.
They'll know me.
Yeah.
And they're
there
just
is.
Excited to
yeah.
see me the yeah. way my baby's excited to see me.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And then you just wait until they resent you.
And then you wait until, until they hate you.
Yeah.
I've always hated him. Yeah, they go, I've never liked him for a couple years.
Yeah.
And then the middle of your third season, they're like, I've always liked him.
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
always ridden hard for
right.
him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, around your fifth year, they're like, he should have left
two years ago.
Like, I know I'm like, I'm generalizing all of the YouTube comments and.
Sure.
AV Club reviews and all of the things that you can look at after an SNL. And
do you look at it?
Believe I'm really learning not to.
Good.
Because I just want to be a comedian.
Good. Well, congratulations. You're doing good. It's good talking to you.
Was this a good one? Did
yeah,
I achieve
dude.
It?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It was great.
It was
How do
great
you feel?
Talking to you. Oh, this is really fun. That's,
good.
This is honestly, it's on that. It's on that list with JFL and SNL. It's like,
oh, well, WTF. Thank you. No,
the three-letter things that
yeah,
you can do.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I think we did the whole thing. I got choked up in a couple places that
oh,
you wouldn't have known.
Nice.
It was good.
Thanks, man.
There's a story. Jesus. This Saturday is the final new episode of Saturday Night Live for this year. That was a... If you're just tuning in for whatever reason, at the end of a podcast, that was James Austin Johnson. All right, look, you guys, hang out for a minute, will you? Here's a reminder. If you're a WTF Plus subscriber, check your email today for the special promo code we sent you, all right? You can give that code to as many people as you want, and they'll be able to get a free month of WTF Plus when they sign up. And when you have any tier of WTF Plus, you get every single WTF episode ad-free. So you can go all the way back to 2009 for episode 38, where I sat in a car with Kyle Kinane and reviewed the original Avatar. Going. All right, yeah. So I'm having a hard time breathing. I'm in the car right now with Kyle Kinane, and we just got out of Avatar. All right, I went. You bullied me into it.
not you, Kyle, but people who were saying that I could not judge a film prior to see. I can't breathe. I'm having a hard time adjusting to the Earth's environment and the atmosphere.
Three minutes out of Avatar, what we pledged not to say anything from the time the movie ended. Everybody stayed to watch the credits because those were in 3D as well.
My mind's a little fucked up. I'm having a hard time adjusting to breathing.
Really?
We saw it in 3D. It was pretty. Mm-hmm. Was it worth $100 million an hour?
Was it $300 million? Is that the price tag of it?
I hear that's the low end. That possibly it's going to be higher than that.
Could they have spent more than $2,500 on the script? Can I ask that much? An army guy saying you're not in Kansas anymore? That's where I checked out the first time.
Okay. Well, there were definitely some archetypes. There was definitely, and I'm using that word in lieu of the word hackneyed.
That's generous.
Hackneyed archetype. Hackneyed characters.
What were they trying to get that they couldn't get? I mean, it was kind of a vague name for something that you wanted to have, but it was difficult. Oh, it was unobtainium.
Unobtainium.
Because hard to gideum, I think, was used in another movie already. Tough to dig upium.
You can't find any of it.
The stuff we want is under these indigenous people's homium. Unobtainium. Go fuck yourself. Come on, really?
I thought that was a joke the first time he said it. And I guess we can't be too much of a spoiler. But
$300 million, you could have paid somebody to come up with a better. You could have given me $100. I could have come up with a better word for something you were looking for that was tough to get other than unobtainium.
Unobtainium. Yeah. Or I hope there's some there or left them. Not much left him.
Unobtainium.
Wild. I barely remember that. Next week, it's Director Week. Ryan Johnson is on Monday. Scott Cooper is on Tuesday. All right, you guys. Open G. I finally locked in to Open G. So here's a little of that. We'll be right back.
Boomer Lives, Monkey and La Fonda. Cat Angels Everywhere.